Hello, and welcome to the Outrider podcast. This is another Shop Talk with Stephen McClurg. And believe it or not, yes, this is the first week following the first Saturday of November. Because, of course, you know, November started on a Sunday, so it's actually the second week, but with the timing and the thing, and anyway, yeah. So even Stephen was a little confused when I finally called to set up the time to talk, because he thought, well, is it over? Yeah, I know. For my five listeners out there, it's we're falling off the log. Yeah, I've got a lot I'm doing. I recently finished the rough draft of a novel. It took me 3 years to write that first draft. Oh my God, that's the longest it's ever taken. What else? What else? Indeed, there's not much. You know, I'm still sending out query letters for the Palace of Winds, and haven't heard much of anything back yet. But we're gonna ramp that up here, just because it's time. It's time to actually get something done. I want to reinforce that there for a minute. You know, just to remind myself. You know that part of being a writer is submitting. The cover letter, the query letter. Oh, good grief. Anyway, Stephen and I had a pretty good shop talk here this time. You know, some new information about his Ghoulanoids project with Derek Ballard from Adventure Time, as well as some discussions of things like Gerard Genet and narrative discourse, and some of the interesting things we've been reading and watching lately. All the things that that writers use to fill their brains with ideas and stories that we then rehash, mutate, synthesize, and spit back out to you as if we were psychics pulling things out of the cosmos. Yeah, that's why sometimes you look up and you realize that someone wrote your story 2 years ago, and you're like, well, why didn't I know about it? And things and so forth. Like when just after I'd finished a revision of The Evolution of Shadows, the movie Harrison's Flowers came out. And I watched the promo for the first time, and my jaw just fell to my chest. And I thought, what the mother? It's about a woman who goes to the former Yugoslavia to look for her photojournalist husband. Son of a bitch! Right. Fortunately, that was in Croatia, and it was for her husband. And mine was about a woman who left her husband and went to actually Bosnia to search for her ex-lover, who happened to also be a photojournalist. But still, something was in the cosmos at that moment about that war when I sat down to write my book, and there was a little bit of a, you know, overlap. It's like the comedians who, independent of each other, without stealing jokes or whatever, came up with a riff on a theme, and they're like, but that's my bit. No, that's my bit. And it's not anybody's bit. It's both their bit, because they have a slight, you know how it. So yes, yeah, that's it. All of my planned interviews have kind of fallen away because I gave up reading some books. That's not to knock any of the potential books that I had, but I think I was getting with my day job, which feels like an obligation. Some of the reading I was doing for the podcast was beginning to feel like an obligation, and I needed to pursue some passions. And so, of course, we'll talk about the things I'm reading in the podcast there. But I've decided to take some time off after finishing this draft, and just not put any pressure on myself, and go and write and do these shop talks and do some reading. So, who knows what will happen? I do want to do some more stuff with the podcast, so maybe you'll hear some interesting stuff. Or maybe it won't be interesting, but you'll hear some different stuff. I hope it's interesting. Otherwise, you know, the last few people that are listening will stop listening. Oh, well. As I've asked before, you know, send some feedback if you feel up to it. I'd love to hear from you. whoever's listening besides Stephen. So let's get to the conversation with Stephen. We had a good time, so I hope you will enjoy it and you know, find some interesting inspiration from the things we've been drawing on. That's really kind of what this is about. We're reaching out to each other to inspire each other, and hopefully our conversations about the things we're reading and watching and taking in will send you in some new directions and open up your own new access or influences and get your juices flowing. Because, you know, believe it or not, despite everything, my talks with Stephen do kind of get me interested in things again. You know, besides, you know, scratching the id that wants to just play video games and ignore the rest of the world. Because I'm a hermit. Right, here we are. Here's my conversation with Stephen. Hello.
Hello.
Cool.
Oh, okay, yeah, that was weird.
Yeah, it kind of immediately dropped us, and we didn't even really connect. That was fun.
Yeah.
So how have you been?
All right. How about you? I was kind of wondering if you were doing this anymore after it hit November and I hadn't heard from you in several days. I was like, well, maybe that's it.
Yeah. No. Well, the first Saturday was a weekend, you know. That was a part of the problem.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. I was just. Yeah.
Yeah, day one was a Sunday, so it was like, yeah, it gave me time to get caught up. It makes it feel like it's been forever.
It made it feel like a little while.
That's what you get for a 5-week October.
Yeah.
Oh, man. Yeah. So the girl's already off to bed?
They're in bed. Ah. Not asleep yet, but we talked to Grandma and Grandpa, and then I don't know if you can hear that, but
yeah, I heard that.
Yeah,
that's
getting ready for bed.
That's not torture. That's getting ready for bed.
Yeah. Same sound. We're pajama pants on backwards.
Right.
So curious. Various things equal that reaction.
Yeah. Everything's a drama at that age, right?
Yeah. There's a lot of it, yes.
Well, we'll see how this one goes. I'm using the old machine tonight, so we'll see.
Okay.
You know, trying to get back into having my tasks separated again. Oh, my. So what have you been reading since last we spoke? I mean, besides Narrative Discourse, you'd sent me an email about that a while ago.
Yeah, I finally finished it.
Cool.
I think it's really useful. It's also something that I think probably what I would do is spot read different chapters on the different ideas, you know, here and there.
Right.
I think part of what it does is it just shows you the complexity of, you know, taking something like narrative, the idea of narrative, and then like building, like attempting to analyze that, break it down into all of its components or as many components as one could.
Yep.
And so I think it's useful for someone who's going to be serious about, I almost don't want to use the word, but deconstructing how narratives are built.
Right.
So in other words, for writers or theorists, a book for craftspeople of that sort. And I don't see, I mean, was this a book that was part of Naropa, or was this just you working out something? I don't see a lot of writers that I've met really getting into it.
No, it wasn't. It
It's the
wasn't
writer's
a.
name.
It wasn't a.
They tended not to like that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I can see why a lot of writers wouldn't like it. You know, they like to feel very organic about their stuff, and you know,
It's a lot of musicians I know too who don't want to learn too much theory or anything because they're afraid that it's just going to kill their spirit, man.
oh, fucking. Listen, you know, the thing is, I was not born with a whole shitload of talent, you know?
I know that feeling.
You know, I don't, I'm not completely lacking in talent, but, you know, I don't know why I threw that book back there. I still might want it. But yeah, it's, no, it was something I stumbled across. It wasn't ever part of the curriculum, anything that they, taught us. But I
That's why
found
I
it.
was curious about that because it didn't feel like a book that a writer would, pick up and like or like have like, hey guys, read this in class and we'll talk about it and just if, unless they really wanted to just feel the stares or just enjoy that quiet that will
I think
answer.
if I ever taught creative writing, I would be teaching that, as a way of being actually more precise about talking about the how we construct our stories.
I talked to him.
Hi.
You need to go back to bed.
I can't see her.
Don't you go back to bed? Yeah.
I can't see her. There's no video.
Easy.
Hi.
Don't you go back to bed? No, quit hiding from your mom. Sorry. So I liked it, but I came out of that kind of theory. I like the theory stuff, so and just liked the complexity of getting into. I mean, I had never thought about Niven the way that he does in that book, or I never broken it down into all these different components.
Right. Yeah, neither had I. I mean, I'd kind of I mean, the way that I'd originally learned how to talk about, you know, story and the mechanics of putting together a story was the language that came out of Wayne Booth's book, The Rhetoric of Fiction. And when I stumbled across Janae and narrative discourse, what got me right away was there was a much what well to me it felt like there was a much more precise use of language in describing the components of a story of how you make a move through time and the duration of stuff and the repetition of things, which was always, you know, spoken of in very vague terms under the old, you know, Booth terminology. What was your point of view? And were you writing in first person or third person? Were you writing in past tense or present tense? And it wasn't, and you really couldn't, was it a flashback or a flash forward? And those things were all very, to me, very vague. And when I stumbled across, you know, Janae, and he was, and I've kind of lost some of that terminology, but the concept is still there that, you know, you have, you know, these iterative, I believe is the right term, statements, these compacted repetition things. I'm going to pull out my book here. What I should do is pull together a glossary of my own
That's what I was building as
and
I was
study
reading
it.
in a notebook.
You know, and that knowing all of that stuff and figuring it out, and then I using that in particular to do my thesis on the English patient, I was, you know, I had this because I had a concept, I had a way of understanding what I was doing and what I wanted to do from a temporal standpoint within the story. That's kind of why I abandoned, writing solely in the past tense, like a lot of other fiction writers, like they tried to teach us, and when I was an undergrad.
Go to bed.
No, I want to give you a kiss.
Okay, give me a kiss. Love you.
Dad.
You're that's not giving me a kiss. Go.
I'll talk to you.
Not right now. We're talking. Okay. You're gonna go to bed.
I suck.
Good night.
Yeah. Okay.
Go to bed. You go to bed. The magic of editing.
Yeah. I'll leave it in there. People need to know that, you're more human than I am. So, but yeah.
I liked all the terms, the way of thinking about it, that normal idea of first person, second person, third person, which is still the way.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'll still probably use that in my classes because that's probably the terminology that they'll see on an AP test or something like that if it's
right
there.
Right.
How it even broke that down in the terms of, well, this is, said to be taking place in the past, but then here's all where it jumps around in the midst mm-hmm. of like one sentence and everything. It
right. That's kind of the dense early part of the book there, where you have him, doing the timeline of a narrative paragraph, But yeah, that whole idea of anachronies and prolepsies and analepsies and all that good stuff was almost revelatory, but what really got me on top of that was the idea, and I'd always kind of had a good solid grasp of what we normally call point of view. But jeez, cat, no. The idea when he started talking about, these focalizations of who's filtering the information to the reader, that was really important as well, because it kind of freed me up to understand how to make a move from across consciousnesses within a story without, breaking the normal kind of laser focus that you need to have with a point of view.
Yeah, and I enjoyed seeing how complex that was, but how we process that, how quickly, most of us don't even notice some of those shifts and all of that, when we read, mm-hmm. we process it and we can still get what's happening. Like, we still read the book and get it, but it's just interesting that there's more going on than just, oh, this is a first person narrative,
right?
Present tense or past tense. I just enjoyed all that. I like that complexity of it.
Yeah. And I don't understand why people wouldn't want to, be able to break apart a story in that fashion. Particularly, I don't see why writers wouldn't be interested in it, although apparently a lot of them aren't. I don't know. Then again, I guess there are some writers out there no matter what, seem to have a problem with plot.
True, yeah.
And with, this, that, no matter how many times you tell them that, the whole, um, Sorry, I just, the cat is like right here next to me and she will not shut up. It's worse than kids because they don't understand English. You can't argue with them. Where was I going with that? Where was I? In case he's listening, I had a friend of who just finished a draft of a novel, and we all sat and a couple of us sat down with him to critique it after having read it. And
that's what you were talking about. Some writer with plot.
Yeah. And he had this is the second novel of this his that I've read, novel in progress of his that I've read. And this time he's gotten a bit more of a handle on what the plot is, but there's still this, he still has this habit of dropping the most important thing and walking away from it.
Like in a Hemingway iceberg sense
It's like he creates early on the expectation that the story is going to be about X. And then he completely undercuts it by, basically walking away from it or forgetting about it or dwelling on it for a really long time. And then when you get to the next section where you expect to see a resolution on it, it just has suddenly forgotten about it.
Mm. Right.
So, and it's an interesting thing. He's aware of the problem. And, we pointed out to him, say, this is where you're losing it. And like I said, it's not as bad as the first novel of his that I read, which there was a lot of meandering about and talking, but no one really had anything at stake. No one seemed to be after anything except for the next chance to tell the story, and that's one of the things he's really good at is getting a character's voice. That driving home and getting to that concept of chasing the character up a tree and surrounding them with dogs and seeing how they get down. That's one of the most raw descriptions of what a story is that I've heard from people. And I guess the best way to describe what happens is that he'll chase the character up a tree, and then the dogs just wander off. Right?
Yeah.
And suddenly he can get down and
just move on to the next tree.
Move on to the next one.
Yeah.
And that's a bit of a problem. And for me, I struggle with stories sometimes too, just trying to, where am I going? Because of the way I feel out stories, I don't really plan things in advance. I write myself into corners all the time and I drop things and forget things and stuff like that. But in all of the critiques of my stories, I've never been accused of there not being something at stake for the characters, of a plot point being forgotten. Maybe that's my weak point, I think, is my characters and my dialogue, but oh boy, that's a big weakness. So yeah, but that's where Janae helped, was that, and particularly reading Ondaatje, was I found that there was a way I could get into those characters and develop the character, by manipulating time and memory in ways that were a lot easier than what I had been doing in the past with the rather broad, blockish, tools that were associated with, flashback and, always writing in, third person omniscient or whatever. You know, by shifting just those little terminologies and the ways of understanding it to this concept of focalization and you know, getting out of, and I guess one of the, not really, this didn't really have anything to do with Jeanne, but the idea of the implied narrator, which is this, or the idealized author, that it's the invented embodiment of the author's self that sits in between the actual writer at the keyboard and the story. Does that make sense?
Oh yeah. Well, yeah. I think it, like Dick Larkin's narrator, but you know, it, you can say it's more subtle in other works, but it's still there.
Right.
I mean, the Dickens narrator talks to you, it is that disembodied voice talking to you, whereas sometimes in others, not directly speaking to you or saying things to you, but it is still telling you the story. So
right. Yeah. So it's been an interesting little development, I suppose, in my own little understanding of it. What else have you been reading? Because I've just been, you know, here's the thing. I started reading Hopscotch and really was like, yeah. And I put it on the kitchen table one day because I was switching bags, you know, with all of my stuff, you know, the laptop and everything like that. And I was switching bags and I put it on the kitchen table and then left it there for 3 days and then put Wittgenstein's Mistress in my bag for some reason, and I've been reading that one.
Yeah, I haven't read that one. I've wanted to, but
so
they both sound interesting.
Yeah, although you know, Wittgenstein's Mistress, I guess, is a good example of an entirely voice driven experimental novel that doesn't really have a plot.
Yeah.
Right. Although I don't think my friend is trying to write an experimental novel. So. But yeah, that's all I've been doing.
I've been listening to Secret Agent by Joseph Conrad, and I've really liked it. Particularly the first section of it, where you introduce basically to a guy who is selling pornography and his family who lives in his pornographer shop. And you learn right for pages that he's the secret agent of the title. And he's asked basically by the government to blow up, to bomb a landmark to get people's attention. And right. Part of it is they want to get rid of some of these, anarchist socialist kind of groups. And, so, or at least put some more heat on them.
Right.
And so they're asking him, and he's got all these connections to them. Huh. To go bomb a particular landmark. And so that first part of the book is really good. And it ends with someone being blown up in a bomb.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't know who it is. And I have a feeling who it is. But he's put all that on hold. Because, and then we sit with the police for a while they're kind of like going over everything, and you're like, just tell me what happened. And then it goes back to the family, and everyone's there. So I don't know. Huh. I don't know what, like, what I thought had happened evidently hasn't happened, because at first when he went back to Verloc and his family, I was like, oh, this.
Okay, went back to Verloc.
And it was a weird timing thing where in the first part of the narrative where you saw them, it went up to the point of the bombing and a little bit after. And then when it starts with Verloc, it rewinds and then moves up to the point of the bombing, and then now it's moving after. So I still don't know what's happened. Yeah, I have no idea what's happened. So it's a fun book, though. It's good.
Well, cool. Who is the author again?
Joseph Conran. Heart of Darkness.
Right, right.
Yeah. I've read some short fiction by him, but I haven't read any of his other novels. So I wanted to give this one a shot. Cool. And it's fun so far. It's going to depend on what this last, I think I have about the last third of the book. So it's going to, like, how I feel about it.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And I started The Social Contract by Rousseau.
Really?
Yeah. I've been reading various 18th century French folks here recently. I don't know why. I think just because they were on the shelf. I was like, I haven't read that Diderot before. And so they both mention the stuff that I've read have mentioned Rousseau, and Rousseau was a friend of Voltaire and Diderot's and all that. So, right. So I just have just really just started that. So, and a little bit of Lucretius's On the Nature of Things. But I'll probably finish this translation, but I'm definitely going to read it in a different translation at some point.
Right.
It's an older translation, and it's okay, but I've heard a different translation before that I liked better, a portion of it, but I just don't know which one it is. So. I'll probably do some comparisons at some point.
Yeah. I'm hoping I can get a lot more reading done, because I finished the rough draft of Far 19 last month, and I'm just going to sit and read.
That's nice. Yeah.
Have you been watching anything interesting lately?
Yeah, I'm trying to think of what. Several. John Huston's The Dead, his version of Joyce's The Dead. It was Huston's last film that he directed.
Huh.
And I've read that story a lot and have dealt with the footnotes and have taught it. And like, so having that kind of history with it,
right,
and then watching the film version of it, it was really cool.
Huh.
And a nice holiday movie without, you know, I don't know. It had moments of beauty, real beauty in it. I enjoyed it. Cool. Ali Fear Eats the Soul. It's a movie by Fassbinder. Is a German director that was part of the new wave of German films.
And is he related or an ancestor? No,
their name's different. Yeah, that's I'd always thought that they were related somehow, but the name's spelled differently, so I assume
they're
related. Yeah, Rainer Werner Fassbinder. And this one's about an older woman who comes into it's raining, and so she walks into like this club for French Arabs, and she dances with one. He's a tall, handsome guy, and they end up getting married. And so it's kind of about their relationship.
Interesting.
Yeah, it's really, really good. And I watched another one of his, The Bitter Tears of Petra von Kant, and it was good. I plan on watching, kind of sitting through when I can do it. I don't have Netflix anymore, so it makes that more difficult.
Really? Dropped Netflix, huh?
Well, I didn't know, but my wife had the Amazon thing, so I had to get rid of one of them.
Right.
If I can ever afford it, I'll go back to the Netflix DVD thing.
Mm, yeah.
Or Blu-ray. There are just so many more options for me.
Yeah.
Watch a Japanese ghost movie, ghost story from the 70s, I believe, called Empire of Passion. It was really good. And it was a fairly traditional, like, Japanese folktale on film, but made I would say in kind of a style of Kurosawa.
Right.
So it was well done and really good. And then I've been watching short art films here and there.
Mm-hmm.
Damn.
No, they released the second season of The 100 on Netflix finally, which is this post-apocalyptic, you know, TV series. I think it's originally on ABC or something like that. Maybe CBS. I don't know. It's based off.
Was that the one that's kind of, does it begin with kind of like a revelation story where they're, or maybe not, or
no.
Were they abducted and came back, or?
No. This is based off of a YA novel or a series of YA novels by Cass Morgan. And it's like 100 years after a nuclear war. And some survivors of the war were actually on a space station. And so this is like the third or fourth generation of people that have been living on this space station. And it starts with them, you know, the station is dying. And so they have to make a decision about whether or not they're going to, return to Earth or not. And, you know, they got really strict laws and rules and stuff like that, you know, to be able to survive up there. And so instead of, they've got about 100 people that have been locked up, you know, mostly young people. And they decide that instead of, in order to buy themselves some time to decide how to get back to Earth, or to get everybody back to Earth, they'll send these 100 kids, basically, down to the planet in a drop ship to kind of, you know, test the waters.
Nice.
Right? And, you know, pretty quickly by the end of the first season, you know, the whole space station is down and everybody who's survived is on Earth. And you find that there's, you know, earthbound survivors, you know, who have adapted to the radiation. And there's people in inside this mountain bunker that have been inside there for 100 years. And, you know, they're just as weird and kooky as the people on the space station were. So it's this, and it all has this. It's kind of like I'd be interested to read the books, but I'm not going to add them to my list because I got enough to read already. But yeah, it's kind of like it's like The Terminator meets Lord of the Flies. Right, but there are no killer robots yet, so it's The Terminator meets Lord of the Flies minus the robots.
Hmm. Yeah, I can't. It gets really hard for me to watch series television. I've talked about it before. I can't deal with the the story arcs and stuff.
The
and
constant, never-ending story arc.
Yeah, I can't. It's really hard for me to. TV shows that I watch almost are always either something like Nova or or like Monty Python or, you know, there's the upcoming, which I wish I still had Netflix for, the Bob and Dave show, which I'm sure would be funny. You know, or comedy stuff that's, you know, not based on long arcs or anything, or even if it is, it never is the same kind of
right.
suspenseful kind of stuff. I don't know what it is. I can watch older shows like Star Trek, or, you know, they're more episodic. So
right.
Twilight Zone, I love shows like that.
Yeah.
I've been watching a little bit of the old Friday the 13th show.
Really?
Have you ever seen that?
Uh-uh.
It's pretty terrible, but kind of fun at the same time. It's basically a bad, like, Twilight Zone or something. but it has nothing to do with Jason Voorhees at all.
Right.
It's this antiques shop where these two characters, like their uncle or something, died, and he had all these magical items in a mm-hmm. book, and in their will, like, they have to reclaim these magical items. and the one I'm watching now, I'm almost done with it. It's the third episode. And the item is a teacup with these particular leaves on them. And in it, there's a rock singer, you know, who's supposed to be punk,
uh-huh.
but she does kind of like a pop metal version of I'm a Little Teapot. It's like her big hit. And then all of her fans are like standing out waiting for her in leather and giant mohawks and stuff. It's right. just, it's so silly and absurd. And the two main characters in it, this person's been strangled in a park, and they just walk into the morgue room where they're doing the autopsy and start asking the detective questions.
Yeah.
They're just like, hey, what are you going to do about these murders in the park? And the detective at first just has a conversation with them over this dead body in the morgue. like, no questions of how'd you get in here?
What do you know, really like, want?
Yeah, it's so it's, you know, yeah, it's yeah. very silly, but I can deal with that. It's kind of funny to watch the, it's at least showing me a lot of things not to do.
Right.
And like, if it makes you cringe like that, like, don't do that.
Right.
Figure out something better to do.
Have you ever seen Eddie and the Cruisers?
Oh man. Yeah. Have you seen the second one?
No.
The second one is, I've been trying to find it again. Oh man. Talk about a cringe fest. The second one is where he hires, you know, no one knows it's Eddie. And he holds these auditions to find all these new guys to be in his band.
Right.
And so it's a lot of really bad music talk and stuff like that.
I was surprised. I rewatched it last night for like the first time in 30 years.
I haven't seen the first one in a long time, probably right. at least that long too.
And... well,
you're stunned into silence.
Well, you know, when I was a kid, you know, this, I watched it because it was one of my little sister's favorite movies. It was like her first awakening of rock and roll, you know, mythology.
Dogs, Dad.
Right?
Whoa, yeah.
Because it's
on
it's
the
kind
ball
of
side.
Because it's kind of this, it, you know, it's. It's a fictionalized, of course, it's a piece of fiction based off of a novel, but it
is it,
it oh, kind, wow. yeah, it kind of, it plays on a lot of the whole, you know, dramatic rock and roll legends, you know, the,
oh yeah, yeah.
You know, the rising star, the genius star who dies early. Right. And, you know, this was kind of, I think, why my sister ended up getting obsessed with, like, you know, Ritchie Valens' story. And
oh yeah, that stuff was big. Like, La Bamba came out maybe before that, but
no, or after. It was 80.
Yeah, was it after a while? Yeah. So it was all around that time you had that. And there was that rebirth of Roy Orbison.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of that 50s stuff got popular around that time.
Yep.
People were redoing it.
And
you know, but and so I was watched it last night. It was part of a rock and roll movie night, volume two. A friend of mine and I, we've been doing this. We're probably going to have two more rock and roll movie nights because we had our first one was the comedy rock and roll movie night where we watched A Mighty Wind, This Is Spinal Tap, and The Dewey Cox Story.
I don't know. Oh, I haven't seen that one.
Oh, my God. That is so fucking hilarious. Anyway, so we watched that. And then tonight was last night was the dramatic rock and roll movie night. Well, not really the dramatic. It wasn't completely dramatic because the first movie was The Blues Brothers.
Yeah.
And then Eddie and the Cruisers. And we were going to watch Almost Famous, but between the talking and the eating and watching the first two movies, by the time we finished the first two movies, it was already midnight.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
So, yeah, we called it quick, and we're going to try and squeeze in Almost Famous, which is, what, 2.5 hours?
I don't know. I never watched the whole thing.
Right.
It
so,
is pretty long.
Yeah, we're going to, I guess, now what we could do is we're thinking about a one that's like the dramatic rock and roll biopic movie night. You know,
and there's one I was just watching a little bit of. I haven't been able to finish it yet. It's on YouTube.
Yeah,
and it's about a band. It's about a band, a motorcycle. Okay, so it's a band that is also a motorcycle group of ninjas. I'll send you the title. It's a VHS only. You know, it came out only on VHS.
Right.
The opening of it's pretty amazing in its, well, yeah. And then it's just one of those things with just the horrible songs, you know, like the total, ignorance. It's like none of those people, it's like no one has ever actually been in a band or,
right.
You know what I mean? Like the whole way that they portray like what a musician's life is like, it's like that is just not, it's insane.
Yeah.
That's what Eddie and the Cruisers too, when he's getting the band together again under a different name, he's also getting people from different genres that were popular at the time, so he's getting a heavy metal artist.
Right.
It's heavy metal guitarist with big hair and like a BC Rich, like cherry red BC Rich guitar. And when he's in the studio recording with that guy, it just made my stomach hurt so bad. He puts his hand over the strings and because the guy's going into the shred solo.
Uh-huh.
And he goes, "No, what are you doing? Whoa." He's like, "When I was out in the desert."
He starts
his story that way, and then he goes, "It was more like this," and he just plays a really crappy blues, you know,
right,
pentatonic scale solo. He just, you know, and it's so, man, the movie is so bad, but it's so much fun.
Yeah, well, I'll have to watch it.
Yeah,
I got the DVD from Netflix, and it's Eddie and the Cruisers and Eddie and the Cruisers 2.
Oh my God!
On one DVD, so
yeah. See, I need to get that DVD. membership back at some point.
Yeah. But yeah, you know, we figure we'll do the biopic movie night. You know, with something like Control and. Which is about Joy Division, and
I've heard that's good.
It is good.
I've heard that's good.
It is really good.
I haven't seen that one.
You know, we'll pick up some other rock and roll biopic type of movies, and then we're going to do the concert movie night.
Oh,
right. So we'll get
Speaking in Tongues. You should watch that one.
Yeah,
it's really good.
Try and get them all to watch. What is it? The Last Waltz. The bands.
Oh, that one's good too.
Oh, yeah.
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 I just watched that a couple months ago. I had never seen it. There's a really good one of PIL playing in Germany. That's on, I think, YouTube. It's a concert thing. Jesus Lizard Show. It's a good one.
Yeah, we could do something like Rattle and Hum, or I've got a
there's got to be some great classic ones out there somewhere that we could.
Oh yeah, there's I'm sure there's a list.
Oh, we could actually do three more rock, because we've got to do the documentary, the rock and roll documentary movie night, which
there's tons, yeah,
which we would do like Muscle Shoals and the Wrecking Crew and
the Muscle Shoals one's good.
Oh yeah, the Wrecking Crew documentary is really good too. Oh, and Sound City. Oh my God, have you seen that one, Sound City?
Yeah, it's good too. The Motown one is good as well. Standing in the Shadows of Motown.
Mm-hmm.
There are a ton of those though. I mean, yeah, there's so many.
Oh yeah, especially just in the last few years. You had the Muscle Shoals and Sound City, and then the Wrecking Crew finally got released. Have you seen that one yet?
I don't think so.
Uh-uh. Oh, yeah, you got to watch the Wrecking Crew one. Because that's about the session musicians out in Los Angeles.
Oh, wow. So does it have Carol Kaye in it?
I don't recall. The documentary was made by the son of one of the guys in the Wrecking Crew.
Oh, okay. I'll have to check it out, yeah.
But yeah, the Wrecking Crew like had Glenn Campbell in it before he went off and became a singer-songwriter in his own right. He was a guitar player in the Wrecking Crew and one of the studio musicians.
Yeah, that's how the Beach Boys picked him up. He was, I'm pretty sure he plays on Don't Worry Baby.
Well, actually, if they actually listed all of the Wrecking Crew players that played on all the albums, every fucking album that was produced in Los Angeles between like 1960 and 1975 or so would be by this core group of people and not by the actual bands whose names are on the covers, right?
Yeah.
And so, yeah. Now they talked to a few people for that. Talked to the woman recorded the original bass line for Mission Impossible.
That's probably Carol Kaye.
Might be. It's been a while since I've...
She... Did it talk about her more in the documentary? Like, did she play guitar first and then shift to electric bass? And
yeah.
Let me look at
the page here.
She played on tons of stuff.
Oh, yeah.
She's awesome. She has a couple of books out on bass technique that had gone out of print, and bass players were kind of trying to find those for years. She's great. There's a video online of her giving a lesson to Gene Simmons. That's pretty
cool. Yeah. Let's see. Oh, Tommy Tedesco was the guitar player with the Wrecking Crew, and his son is the one who made the documentary. And it took forever to get the documentary released because he had to secure all the rights.
All the rights to the songs.
And because there were so many goddamn songs that he had to have in the documentary for it to even have any meaning.
Makes sense, yeah.
There were so many rights he had to get for it. Yeah, Carol Kaye. Glenn Campbell was in that group. All sorts of people. But yeah, it's a really good documentary.
Yeah, what Phil Spector used to do is, in terms of bass nerdery here, he would use an upright, a Fender 6, and then an electric, the Fender bass, and he would blend those three together, supposedly. And then Brian Wilson, when he started doing it, he would just take like a Carol Kaye bass line and an upright, and they would double off him.
Yeah.
Howlin' Wolf does that on... who's the other guy? Willie Dixon.
Mm-hmm.
Willie Dixon, and of course he played like on a lot of the Howlin' Wolf stuff. So
wow.
What they would do a lot of times is they would do the same thing, is I couldn't figure out on some of the Howlin' Wolf records, like how the bass, I couldn't figure out how they were getting the bass tone they were getting. And what I found out is that they were doubling and running them together, an upright and an electric. And,
right.
So when I started, I would do that. I started doing that for some recordings. When I write a particular bass line, I would double them like that. So upright and then double it with an electric with a pick and stuff like that.
Huh.
So you get like a different attack sound, but then you get the kind of boom of an upright.
Right.
Oh, man.
It's fun stuff from a former life.
Yeah. So what are you getting out submitted? What have you got out? Have you heard anything back on it lately?
Yeah, we're still comic book crazy. Actually, today, you know, again, I don't know. we've got a project that we're securing rights to. It will be a project based on a cult movie.
Oh, wow.
So we'll see what happens with it. Supposedly, though, it's – I don't know. I guess I could say maybe 80% likely. I don't know.
That's cool.
So yeah. So that'll be neat. Ghoulanoids is likely to start going online. So it will be part of a comics group online.
Oh wow!
And then from that, what we'll do is once we have enough done, I mean, part of it is our publisher Drippy Bone is not going to exist at the end of the year.
Oh, wow.
So as far as I know, I don't know if they've made like a formal announcement. I mean, I don't know who even knows who they are, but,
right.
Yeah. So we're kind of like, we have some offers for it, but the best offer was a particular online group.
Uh-huh.
And so that first one, if anyone got it, I think we sold several hundred or something like that. You know, those will be, I guess, collector's items if it is becomes interesting to people anymore after that. It's a big storyline. I've already written at least four or five issues.
Right.
It'll just depend on if there's enough readers and people are interested in it when it starts online, then, you know, we'll work on that. Derek's got a couple of other projects that he also has to do.
Right.
We still have a couple of books that we have to get out. so this one is supposedly going to take precedent. We have a couple of deadlines. Mm-hmm. I've already met my part of it. It's really going to be him. Getting a couple of his getting the artwork done, and he's doing. He's posted stuff on this one, so I can talk about it. I won't give away how it's working, but he's doing a. I may have mentioned it last time. The kind of weird knife zine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think so.
Oh, okay. Yeah, so that's I've got one after he kind of put the book together. He developed these characters, and so he wants me to kind of write for these particular characters, so I have a whole right. section of that to do. But other than that book's done. He's drawn a lot of it.
Cool.
So it's close. I don't know. Well, I think that's actually going to go into it. I think instead of being a standalone,
mm-hmm.
I think it's actually going to go into an anthology.
Okay.
Because originally he was going to take it to Comic Arts Brooklyn. That was this weekend, but he wasn't able to finish it. So I think we're going to use it for an anthology that we were asked to do. Cool. And then, yeah, So, and now I'm waiting to hear about this other option. So,
right.
We'll see. Excellent. And I've got some poems. I was finally actually, like, this is the first time in a while I've done, you know, there's the traditional submitting.
Right, so I'm right.
waiting to hear. And there's a couple of other things I want to get to, though, but it was a grading period this week.
Yeah.
You know, it's a whole other job. I can't stress that enough for people wanting to write and do it. Like, the checking out your options and for different magazines and publications and actually doing the work of reading them and thinking about it.
Yeah.
And putting together submissions and submission groupings and packages. It's like another job outside of just doing the writing, and then outside of whatever daily job you're gonna have.
Right.
So,
it's crazy. It is insane.
Yeah.
Well, I need to get on the ball and send out some more query letters. I've kind of let that drop last week. I wanted to do that a bit more.
Yeah, you were doing that though for a little bit, weren't you?
Yeah. Although I kind of tapered off the last few weeks of October, and then during that 2 weeks ago, was the last time I sent out a query letter.
Weren't you thinking about reconstructing that book though?
No, just reconstructing the query letter.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. I've pretty much got, the Palace of Winds.
Okay.
As solid, I think, as I can make it on my own, and with the readers I've had look at it, and it's now up to an agent or an editor if they see anything. But yeah, I have to find someone who wants it, and I'm always worst at query letters. So I've been rejiggering it and playing around with it, and I think I might finally have come up with a synopsis that isn't boring.
Yeah.
So
all that stuff is, yeah, we've talked about how annoying all that is too.
Yeah. So now I just got to get my my trigger finger needs to be itchy so that I start firing off more query letters. But yeah.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to doing some more of that and hopefully getting some more stuff placed, you know,
right.
Mostly poems right now, but, I'm going to try to get back into working, on more fiction. Cause fiction's always been kind of off and on for me.
Mm-hmm.
Never something that I've been able to kind of to work on sustained over a period of time. And,
right.
And I would like to, and so I don't know, I've been able to do nonfiction and essays and that kind of stuff,
mm-hmm.
but I would like to get some more fiction, like work in that.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. I did finish my script for this graphic novel that I've been kicking around with a friend of mine here who's an artist. Now he just has to draw the damn thing. Right.
Yeah.
So I'm waiting to get some feedback from him on the story.
Yeah. What format did you write it in?
Real kind of a loose script type of thing. I just kind of gave him some basic,
similar to a film.
Yeah.
Script. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, just
that's how I prefer to write.
Really broad description of the action and let him just decide how he's going to frame it all up and place it and everything.
Yeah. That's cool. Yeah, it's I've had to do a few times page panel breakdowns,
uh-huh.
which are okay. I don't mind doing those, but I would much prefer to work with an artist who
doesn't want that.
Yeah, because they're the director of it, and it gives them the freedom to.
Right.
And I like offering options, you know, of particular aspects of the story, like here's, you know, three versions of this, like what, you know, what do you like better,
right?
Different things like that. But I with Derek, I almost always just work in a a film script, like I'm basically writing a film script and giving it to him rather than like breaking down the panels of of action for him, just letting him.
Yeah, I just did some broad descriptions of action, you know, who mm-hmm. looks at what, you know, where they, you know, if they're you know, fighting, if they need to walk across a room or, you know, pick up an object or open a door or something, you know.
Well, what is it about? Yeah, I can't remember you've been talking about
well, it.
Are you waiting to...
The idea actually came from my friend Mikey, who's the artist for it. And he had kind of wanted to tell this sort of supernatural story about, you know, sort of mythological supernatural story with basically, I guess what you could call it is, you know, kind of Grim Reaper, you know, death angels type of things like this. And what we came up with was that you have, starts off with this woman who was in a terrible accident at some point early on before the story starts. And she sees, butterflies that nobody else can see. And she starts following them around and she finds out that what these are little harbingers, that show up for a guy whose job it is to go out and stage the deaths of people whose, we call them quantum twins, whose quantum twin in the world has died. And so this guy, who we call a harvester, has to go out and stage the death of the other twin to maintain balance in the universe or in the world, in the cosmos. And when that person dies, there another twin shows up who is of the harvester, who we call an escort, who's supposed to take this person, you know, across, you know, our version of the River Styx into the afterworld. And this woman, our main character, she can see all this and she's not supposed to. And it turns out it's all this, you know, we end up dealing with a lot of Joseph Campbell stuff and mythology things, you know, so there's, these are, it's all a big attempt to rejigger the universe. The world has become stagnant and stale, we find out through the course of this story, and our trickster figure, our anti-hero, is out there manipulating people to upset the balance of the universe. And part of that was creating this woman who can see things she's not supposed to be able to see, and she disrupts everything a little bit more, and, you know, everything's reordered by the end of the story.
Well, sounds cool. Sounds interesting.
That's like the worst fucking description ever. You know,
that's not usually your kind of thing either.
No, but... it's not. I mean, I just let her rip, you know, which is probably a good exercise for me, but
I think so. I think probably, yeah.
So yeah, this particular harvester that she runs into, he's, you know, he's disillusioned with his job, and he doesn't want to be killing people anymore, and so he abstains from killing now that he's got this woman, and he's trying to help her figure out why she can, you know, see all of these secret goings on with the butterflies and the you know, the escorts, and, you know, she can basically see what's going on in the afterlife. And so throughout the course of the story, he's completely surrounded and encased by butterflies, which he's supposed to follow and, you know, kill somebody because of, and he's refusing to kill anyone. So he's just, you know, the whole story was written so that we could have a character who was completely covered in butterflies. Whoops, I think I lost you. Are you still there? That was an adventure. Yeah. I'm glad I noticed right away that that I'd lost you.
Yeah, I think our internet here went down or something. I don't know. None of the her stuff up front was working, so
I wonder how long I babbled before I noticed.
Yeah, I heard I think up to the point to where the kind of Reaper character, the Harvester, is helping her kind of drop. He drops his duties to kind of help her figure out what.
Why she can see the whole thing, and then as they're doing that, our deity figure sends his Furies out to. Bring the trickster figure in and put everything to rest. So there's, it's very heavy on the mythological imagery, and trying to blend stuff from all different cultures of mythology. So we're sucking in Greek mythology, we're sucking in some Egyptian mythology, some Hindu mythology, and kind of mushing it all together. You know, a la Joseph Campbell, you know.
Yeah, so, that sounds cool.
Interesting. I'm going to have to figure out how to, you know, summarize the damn story. Because I obviously don't know how to do it right now. So yeah, that's about it.
Yeah, I'm hoping to, other than when I find out about these other things I need to get written, get some more submissions out there and try to find time to write for some others. So
yeah. Well, I might, if Mikey ever gets some pages drawn, I might hit you up for some contacts, or at least some advice on how to submit, you know, graphic work.
Yeah, Derek will probably be able to help with that more than anything else. Yeah, a lot of comic stuff is weird. I mean, it really, a lot of it starts with the kind of zine and that kind of stuff. Like, self-publishing doesn't have the the reputation that it has in, you know, say, fiction or poetry.
Right, right. So, yeah, I mean, let's just find out what we need to do to get it out there into the world. Because I have no idea where to start.
Yeah, I mean, what we found is a lot of people are serializing it somehow online and gaining readers that way. And then more people tend to buy the actual books when they come out. And you can kind of use that as leverage maybe to get that. The other thing that a lot of people, image is, the image company is a way to get distribution depending on the content of it. Because they're distributed everywhere through Diamond.
Right.
But you have to, and it works, but you have to have, you know, I mean, you almost have to have a producer who's willing to, like, you don't make anything back on it until the book makes enough money to pay for the publishing costs, but you get distribution. So it's a weird, thing. And as far as graphic novels, I haven't really like a full graphic novel. We've been lucky where we've had people ask us. So I haven't, and not me. They're asking Derek, 'cause they want his artwork.
Right.
And that's mostly coming with through his Adventure Time credentials. So
right.
Yeah, graphic novels are going to be that likely may be a different thing. You know, the biggies are like Pantheon and Fantagraphics and folks like that.
Yeah. Yeah. My first thought was always to submit it, to break it up into its various chapters and try submitting it to Heavy Metal, but that's about as extensive as
I don't know what's going on with that. You know, they're bringing it back and all that, so I don't know what they're looking for. I haven't I imagine it's going to have, at least as it starts, it's going to have some readers, I imagine.
Well, Heavy Metal never stopped.
Oh, I thought it was gone for a while.
No. Kevin Eastman's, it's been going.
Okay. But Grant Morrison's going to be editing, sort of?
Or I don't know.
Editing?
Yeah.
There was some articles that came out about that recently. Or he's going to be the Alfred E. Newman of it now? I don't know.
Yeah.
The kind of
yeah, it's about time for me to renew my subscription to Heavy Metal, but I was aware of it, you know, when I was in high school, because a friend of mine had some, and then when I got to college, I started, you know, buying issues off the newsstand every time they came out. So that was 1990, and then over the years, I've, you know, had subscriptions and let it go. And
I've never looked at an issue, but man, I saw that cartoon when I was like 7 or 8.
The movie.
Yeah, the movie.
Yeah. Oh, that was so good.
It's one of those things came on late at night on HBO.
Yeah. And then they did another one a couple of years ago. Fact 2 was the
really I'm not aware of that one.
Yeah, the model for that, for the character, for the main character, that was Julie Strain. You know who she is?
Oh wow, yeah.
Yeah.
It's been a while since I've heard that name.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's or used to be at one point Kevin Eastman's wife. He was the publisher of Heavy Metal.
Oh wow.
Yeah.
Wow. Is he still the publisher, or is that why they have Grant Morrison? Oh, okay, he's still the.
Yeah, I believe so. I don't think anything along that has changed. Let's take a look. Yeah. Where's the masthead? Whoops, come back. Yeah, Kevin Eastman's still the publisher. Leonard Mogul was the founder, of course, but still going strong, man. That's you know, my that's kind of my one lone comic book, you know.
I assume, is it an anthology? Like, is it published as an anthology? Or?
No, it's a quarterly. Or no, it's every other month. But then they have special editions, so, you know, depending on how often they come out with their special editions, it can sometimes appear to come out every month.
But it's not a continuous story, right?
No. It's an anthology thing every month. So
I figured it was like the cartoon.
Oh, we'll have to.
it's.
I'll have to hook you up.
I need to check it out. I don't know why I've never looked at it. It's just the cartoon is what I've always known.
Yeah. What's the what are they always? What is it? I think their masthead slogan changes every now and then, but it's like the world's premier adult illustrated fantasy magazine. Right. And the only reason when I first started picking it up, it was mostly because there was, you know, illustrated nudity and sex.
Yeah.
You know, because, and when I picked it up was right in the middle of when Serperi was doing the Druna cycle and the Creatura stuff. Which, that was some good stuff.
Yeah, I don't know it at all. Yeah.
Oh my God. Yeah, we got to get you into that. I'll send you some stuff.
Yeah, I don't know it at all. Yeah.
Yeah, that was.
I've never even looked at an issue. It just always lived in my mind as a cartoon I watched as a kid.
Yeah. Oh, fuck. You would love the artwork, man. It's so varied from time to time. I mean, there's some artists in there that I'm not particularly a fan of. And you know, those aren't my favorite issues, but there are sometimes artists that pop in there. I'm just like, oh my God, I love looking at this. And the story's okay. And you know, they actually do a lot of serialized stuff from European artists and storytellers. So,
I bet Mobius was in there a lot.
Yeah,
he's one of my favorites. I mean, this stuff's great.
Mm-hmm.
There's also a guy I've seen recently, Philip Druitt or something like that. His name, and all I've seen I've only seen illustrations, and I'm not even sure if he did comics. But if he did, they would be pretty amazing.
Right.
I'm not sure. Some of the stuff that I've seen was around the 70s, so I don't even know if he was doing that kind of work or not.
But yeah, H.R. Giger had stuff that appeared in heavy metal back in the 70s.
Did he do stories or just illustrations?
Illustrations. And he might have also illustrated other people's stories. I don't know. But Richard Corbin, Pepe Moreno, let's see, who are some of the other people they had listed here? Yeah, they don't list very many artists on this thing, but Guido Kripax,
John
Giraud, Milo Manara.
Jean Giraud is Mobius.
Tanino Liberatore, you know, and of course Kevin Eastman, you know, created or co-created the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, right? So yeah, there's been a lot of huge, important, you know.
Yeah, Kripax did the Emmanuel stuff and some other titles over in Europe.
Yep, and those and a lot of and they got Americans got exposed to that through heavy metal.
Oh, okay. I didn't know that. I'd only kind of seen those later. Yeah, the Kripax stuff and the Mobius stuff is all really good.
So yeah, it's we'll have to get you a few issues here.
You have to look for them. I don't know. I mean, yeah, I don't know what store would have.
Watermark Books here in Wichita used to carry it through one of their magazine distributors, but I was the only one that ever bought it.
Yeah.
Right. So they don't care, and you know. For whatever reason, their distributor doesn't carry it anymore, and they don't have it on the shelf anymore. So I have a subscription that I need to renew.
That happened to me a lot with Wire. It's a British music magazine, but you know, they have people like, or at least when I was reading it, like Stockhausen on the cover, and they had Peter Thomas, who was this European soundtrack composer and stuff. And you know, I'd go crazy. I was like, man, I can't believe this person's on the cover of this magazine. And liked it a lot. And, but I was, I think, frequently the only person buying it around here. So it would often show up for a couple of months and then disappear. And it was, it's even more expensive now, but it was fairly expensive then. And I had a subscription for a while, but it's just, it, it really, it costs a lot to order.
I'm going to send you a link here real quick. See, what else should we cover here real quick before we knock off for the night?
Yeah, whatever you want to. I'm not sure. As usual, I have the...
Well, we've got the... Do you have any random thoughts? We've covered just about everything except for music and random thoughts here.
Well, as far as music goes, I haven't been listening to anything in particular.
Were you ever a big fan of New Order?
Not really. I
what about the Afghan Whigs?
Not really.
I don't think we have anything more to ever talk about, Stephen.
There are songs here and there by both that I listen to, but I never, I don't think I've heard a whole album by either.
Yeah.
And I think New Order was poppier than what I was wanted to hear at the time. I always liked Joy Division from the first time I heard them,
but
New Order was just maybe too much. And then when Afghan Whigs were playing, I was into like death metal and stuff like that. So I was listening to, I mean, when that stuff was out, I was listening to either jazz like Charles Mingus, lots of classical. I don't think I'd hit my Mahler phase at that point, but probably I was probably listening to a lot of just generic collections of classical music and then a lot of death metal. So
it's an interesting Afghan combination.
Wigs, yeah. Afghan Whigs just, I mean, other than that, like I also listen to stuff like, you know, 10,000 Maniacs or REM or whatever, but Afghan Whigs sat in that medium of stuff that,
No, they hit me kind of late. I mean, I got Gentlemen right about the time that it came out in the mid-90s. And, you know, listened to it and liked it, but didn't go out and buy any of the other Afghan Whig stuff. And then right about the time when I started writing The Evolution of Shadows, something snapped in my brain, and I kind of started obsessively listening to Gentlemen, which I'd had for, you know, 5 or 6 years by that point and hadn't ever really listened to. And then slowly started buying more and more Afghan Whig stuff, and then realized that I needed to, that, you know, the Whigs had broken up and Dully had released a solo album. And then he had went out and formed the Twilight Singers and did some stuff with Mark Lanegan from the Screaming Trees. They formed a little group called the Gutter Twins and put out an album and an EP. And the more I began to listen to it, the more I became obsessed with his music and the way he kind of views the world. So yeah, it's kind of that dark, mysterious, obsessive, guilt-ridden junkie kind of mentality, right?
Yeah, I don't. I mean, I've always known the band, and I remember the, you know, Dooley's side stuff, but I just never listened to it much.
Yeah,
I guess with New Order, I was always more. I think in England there was more of a rivalry between them and the Cure for some reason. I don't know why. Maybe there wasn't. I could be making that up, but
yeah.
I did listen to the Cure a lot.
Yeah, the Cure was definitely influenced by Joy Division a lot. But yeah, no, that's what I found interesting is that there are a lot of people I run into in the States are either New Order fans or Joy Division fans, but not very often both.
Yeah, like I said, I remember Blue Monday and the video directed by the French guy where the people are slapping each other.
Yeah, that's True Faith.
Yeah. I remember that.
If you have any New Order trivia, I have the answer for you.
that's pretty much where it ends for me. That's all I really have heard by them. But Joy Division,
yeah,
I've heard a lot of. There's someone I intend to sit down and listen to the albums in order at some point, but I just haven't made it there.
I can help you with that.
I like their stuff a lot.
It's very dark. It's very bleak at times.
Yeah, I didn't hear it until way later. I would have liked it a lot as a kid, I know.
When I'm feeling particularly fatalistic at work, I play some Joy Division songs and it gets me through the day. You know. But yeah, that's about, you know. So who musically are you obsessed with in that way that you almost get evangelical about their work?
I mean, the one composer performer I can say that I've ever had that feeling really deeply is Mingus, Charles Mingus, his work. And I haven't really gone back and listened to it in a little while, but I mean, I think the album, the first one I heard, it's called Blues and Roots, I believe. Mm-hmm. And, I heard that I was somewhere between the ages of 16 and 18. And I was listening to, Miles Davis and Coltrane and different stuff like that. And, it just radically, I don't know. And he's definitely that music. It always has been. I just haven't, you know, I haven't listened to it in a while. I don't know why. I listen to it a lot. I mean, definitely obsessive level of finding everything, reading everything. I was learning as much of the music as I could on either piano, guitar, or bass. Like I would record versions where I would play all the parts, stuff like that, like really or play. And also, anytime I could write a part, a bass line or something where I could quote something or kind of work something in of his, I was fairly obsessive over Mingus' stuff for a very long time. I just haven't, once I had, we had the first kid, I had to change things.
Right, right.
Music was that thing that is really hard to do with kids, and I haven't had the same. I have more of like a practical relationship with music. It's like, okay, I have 30 minutes here where I can write or revise, and this is probably the only time I'm going to be able to listen to something I want to. So,
right,
it has to be able to fit these certain parameters. And lately, that's been a lot of American minimalism, a lot of American minimalist composers. Hmm. So, like Terry Riley, Steve Wright, Philip Glass, that kind of stuff.
Okay.
Michael Nyman, who's not American but fits into that minimalist
right
style. Sometimes.
Okay. Huh.
But I mean, I've gone through various Beach Boys and Brian Wilson, particularly through that 66 to 72 period, but beyond that, like mm-hmm. everything. John Zorn, Mark Ribot, Ken Vandermark, Sun Ra, Talking Heads. I had everything and obsessively listened to all of it. Morphine.
Oh, yeah.
A great band. I've had various, Ennio Morricone still,
mm-hmm.
But now I've listened to so much of it. Ornette Coleman, Miles Davis. I mean, I probably right. like 40 albums at one time by Miles Davis. Thelonious Monk as well.
Right.
John Coltrane. I had pretty much anything that had been put out on CD. I mean, in high school, I went through a phase with like Hendrix, where like he had at the time had maybe five official releases,
mm-hmm.
like the three Experience albums, and then maybe Band of Gypsies, not counting Woodstock. I mean, that's maybe four. I can't think of like during his life if anything else came out.
Right.
Maybe Isle of Wight, but I don't know if that was released. But I had like 25 Hendrix releases on CD so I've cycled through various ones, but probably the deepest is still likely Charles Mingus.
Hmm. Okay.
I mean, the Talking Heads too were big. I remember seeing those videos, and they had a pretty profound effect on me as a kid.
Right, right. Hmm. Cool. Where should I start with Mingus? What would be the album I should start with?
If Blues and Roots is the name, that one's I like a lot. Mingus Ah-Um.
Okay.
Is one that I think is... He did like three albums for Columbia in 1959, and that group of records are all really good. Mingus Ah-Um's probably the most famous.
Okay.
And you can probably you can probably check them out on Spotify or YouTube first, just to see if it's anything that you would even be interested in. From there, I mean, there's
right, but that's where I need to start.
Yeah, Mingus Ah-Um is usually the first one. That one or Blues and Roots.
Okay. Cool. That'll work. That's where I'll start.
Yeah, it's... Yeah, I can't imagine life without Mingus's work.
Well, I think we did well tonight.
All right, yeah, hopefully.
Except for that big, giant technological problem there. We'll figure this out eventually.
Yeah, I think the only other one we've erased was a nighttime one, so we'll see.
Yeah, one will be cool. This is just a little technical thing, but I'll talk to you again soon.
All right. Sounds good.
All right, there you have it. the latest Shop Talk with Stephen McClurg. Looks like we'll be heading into the holidays, so who knows what will happen. Yeah. Be on the lookout. If anything, you'll hear from us the first week in December. And we'll talk about stuff again. And we'll do stuff again. And we'll have been gotten fatter because of Thanksgiving. And then we'll get even fatter because of Christmas. So you know how it goes. See ya. And the obituary. Oh yeah, cockroach nets, rattling traps. How many devils can you fit up on a match? And curiosity killed the Kerouac cat. Sometimes truth is stranger than fiction. In Miami, round the corner, there's a white old man with shoulders and a spirit giving it for crack. You'll never want it back. There's a little kid and his family eating breakfast like Thanksgiving at a back of wild desperados run for a baby. The world is scratching at my door. Obituary. Oh yeah, cradle fun cat, warm looks back. How many angels can you fit up on a match? I wanna know why Hemingway cracked. Sometimes truth is stranger than fiction. Life is the crummiest book I ever read. There isn't a hook, just a lot of cheap shots.